Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land break, right in the middle of the international break. I know the international break can be quite painful, and we are going to try to cure your blues from the international break. Alex definitely has a bad case of it, and I think today we have the perfect episode for that. You know, I got up, it's Friday morning, I have a bounce in my step because yesterday we recorded two really awesome interviews, and I think they are perfect for the weekend coming up and the international break because they are a lot of fun. At the end of the show, we are going to pay tribute to one of my favorite musicians ever, Eddie Van Halen, who passed away earlier this week, with our great friend Andrew Barker. And the thing that stands out to me about Van Halen's music is the pure joy and how smiley the whole band was when they were playing live. So we are going to have a lot of fun this episode, and I think you will love the interview with Steve from Milan Weekly Pod. We chatted about Milan, we had a really good time, so you'll have that. And Andrew Barker, we chatted a little bit about Inter, but mainly about Eddie Van Halen's life and legacy. So that's going to be the bulk of the show today. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our dear friend, producer, and co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg, who's having a rough time dealing with the international break. But Alex, I want to ask you this, because you know a lot of players, you are familiar with them, and I've been thinking a lot about this Chiesa situation. So obviously Chiesa came through Fiorentina's youth system, joined the club around when he was 10 years old. He's in his early 20s now. He leaves the club to join bitter rivals Juve, and you know, I know for Juve maybe Fiorentina isn't a big rivalry, but for Fiorentina this is by far their biggest nemesis, is Juve. So I want to ask you, Fiorentina, both their sporting director Prade and president Comiso were very upset with the manner of Chiesa's departure. Comiso said he had not received a phone call from Chiesa, and sporting director Prade felt like he was used by Chiesa's father, who was a prominent Italy striker in the 90s, and he felt And he said that it Chiesa's father, Fiorentina, was just a vehicle. So there was a lot of bad blood there. Unfortunately, this created a really bad environment. And Chiesa's younger brother, Lorenzo, plays for Fiorentina's youth system. And he received an insane amount of insults on social media because of his brother's departure, which was really unfortunate. So I want to ask you, Alex, as someone, you know, familiar with players, and obviously a lot of the ones you know came through Chelsea's youth system, do you feel someone like Chiesa, who spent so much time at Fiorentina, owed the club a phone call and maybe a nice farewell for the fans? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, without jumping too much into details that I wouldn't know about, the way you lay it out, absolutely. I think you owe him at least a phone call. I mean, you spend so much time there, and that's just the critical part of your development, starting from 10 to now. I mean, that's when you really, excuse the phrase, but you turn from a boy into a man, and that's when you really should be able to look back at your time at the club and say, they helped me develop as a player and a person. So I think I'm probably a very biased person to ask because I, like you said, no, you know, a good handful of players, a lot of them were part of the Chelsea Academy, and they rave about what the Chelsea Academy had done for them. And David, probably even more telling, I take the opinions of the people who are no longer with Chelsea even more seriously because they still speak so highly about the club and how much that club always cared for them. I've interviewed guys who have been on 8 different loans while at Chelsea, and they would talk about all the care, the personal care that was being sent their way throughout the seasons when they could have felt alone. So when they eventually did cut ties with Chelsea, I mean, besides the public message, right, where these guys write paragraphs saying how much Chelsea meant to them, I'm sure if they wrote that publicly, then behind closed doors in a non-COVID world, they're giving hugs and kisses and really like thanking everybody at the club for doing what they did with them. I'll give you a great example, and this is a skewed example, is Declan Rice, of course, is now a huge player for West Ham, Chelsea were trying to get him this past window. He got released by Chelsea when he was 14. This is a bit different than Chiesa, but it's still a fairly good example. Got released by Chelsea when he was 14. Huge shock to him. Huge shock to the Mount family, who obviously he's really close with. Huge shock to many players, probably. Even a Calcio listener would know the name of who was with Rice at the time. So, you know, you could have a little vitriol towards Chelsea, but I just probably use that as a chip on his shoulder. And then he's been with West Ham ever since he was 14. And David, the day he does leave West Ham, whenever that is, sure, he's Chelsea through and through. He's Chelsea blood. That's where he's all started. But I guarantee you, as messy as West Ham is right now, and boy, are they messy with their ownership and everything. They are really bottoms up. He'll probably give the nicest private and public message towards the people at West Ham. So, yeah, once again, maybe there's something that we don't know about this situation, but on the surface, doesn't look too great from Chiesa. Honestly, because how much time is that going to take out of your schedule to maybe, even if you don't mean it, David, you know, maybe there is something that's bothering you that we don't know about. Still, just do it. Just give him a phone call. Say thank you. You know the people you probably should thank. You're going to make a massive move to Juve. They can be in your rear view now. You can hate them if that's how you feel. Fiorentina, I'm speaking of. You can really get juiced up for the times you play Fiorentina. You're at Juve now. I mean, how much time is it going to take? How much of a hassle is it going to be to give him a little bit of a nice farewell? So, yeah, once again, assuming that these are pretty much the facts, I would come down a little bit hard on Chiesa. I just think this is kind of a little petulant and pathetic. Yeah, so that's my answer, David. What did you make of all of it?
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting scenario. And I definitely think you made a lot of really good points. And I was interested in hearing your perspective because, again, you know, players, Chelsea has a tradition of developing players. Fiorentina, not to that extent, but definitely, I mean, Chiesa, I mean, I wouldn't say he's been their best player recently, but definitely the crown jewel of the club. You know, in Italy, call him a figlio d'arte. His father was a famous player, highly rated player, came up through the youth system, played for all the Italian national team youth teams. So, yeah, I mean, we knew he was kind of gunning for a move to a top club in Italy, and that in and of itself already made things harder for Fiorentina. I think Fiorentina, all things being equal, would have much rather selling him abroad compared to Juve. Of course, I think they'd much rather see him go to Inter because of the connections to the fans. So, yeah, it's an odd situation. Do I think Chiesa would it have been absolutely better if he called Commisso to thank him? Because Commisso really did try hard to keep Chiesa. I give him credit for trying, but, you know, maybe it's possible he kind of misread the situation. I get he didn't want to sell Chiesa right upon becoming the owner of the club. It kind of would have sent a bad message, but we talk about it's better to sell a player a year too soon than a year too late. Granted, he couldn't have known about COVID, the financial impact, but Chiesa had very little time left on his contract, had huge leverage. By this time around this year, if he said, look, I'm going to Juve, he pretty much could make it happen. And Juve ends up getting him on what I think is a great deal. I'm not a big Chiesa fan. And I've mentioned on Tuesday's podcast, I'm concerned it's going to hurt Kulusevski's development because to me, they are very similar players. But if you can get Chiesa for that deal, you're paying $2 million up front, then $8 million, and then $40 million later on. Look, within 2 years, even if you're not a Chiesa guy as an asset, he's worth more than that. So to me, it's a great deal for Juve. Poor look on Chiesa's part, but for me, even worse look on Fiorentina. And, you know, I never justify anyone insulting a 16-year-old on social media. I don't care the provocation. I don't care the environment. You're just a douchebag if you do that, period. So I don't condone that in any way. I've seen some people in Italy say, oh, you know, all these insults to Lorenzo Chiesa, 16-year-old kid, is really the culmination of all the media, the environment the media creates in Italy. I wouldn't go that far, in my opinion. If you attack a 16-year-old on social media, like you're just a dickhead on your own, it doesn't really matter what else happened. But I do think Fiorentina went out of their way to really spin Chiesa as a bad guy on his way out. Because let's be honest, that changes the storyline a bit from we just sold our signature player to our bitter rivals. And not only did we sell him, we let him go on this 2-year loan deal with very little money up front, which, sorry, no matter how you spin it, that's not what you want. I don't think anyone, had you told a Fiorentina fan at the beginning of this year or last year, this is how it was going to end for Chiesa, I don't think anyone would have said, hey, you know, that's a great outcome for us. So I don't know. I'm with you. I think Chiesa should have been, you know, definitely a nice message to the fans, came up there, called the club. Granted, it would have been poorly received by fans because he went to Juve. I didn't expect him to do the Roberto Baggio thing where he was really worn out from going to Juve. He probably didn't really want to do it, and he had strong affection for Fiorentina. I didn't expect Chiesa to go that route, but certainly a little bit better. But I do think Fiorentina changing the storyline from we sold our signature player to Juve to this guy left on horrible terms, maybe also not great either.
Yeah, David, but I just wanted to
something that, go
yeah,
ahead.
I just wanted to piggyback off of that, because in my answer, I kept saying, well, if these are the facts, if this is exactly how it's outlaid,
yeah,
which in my voice, you can probably tell that I have a little skepticism that this is all on Chiesa and not on Fiorentina. And I think you're spot on that from a PR standpoint, why wouldn't you spin it as Chiesa's leaving you in the dust and you did everything to keep him? And actually, I hate to tie back in the whole Declan Rice thing, but I know for a fact that if they had sold Declan Rice, West Ham, they would have spun it where the player just put them in a position they couldn't do anything about it. He wanted to leave. Chelsea came. They were helpless. Like, they would have spun it to the high heavens that they did everything possible to keep him, and he just left. So much so, David, I know, and this is a little bit like behind the football, if you will, I know that West Ham, I actually haven't even said this on my own podcast, but maybe I have. I know that West Ham were actually almost cynically wanting Chelsea to bid for Declan Rice just so they could reject it and say to their fans, especially their season ticket holders, look, we told you we were going to reject a bid for Rice, and we did. So I think you're spot on about how Fiorentina could be spinning it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, well, one thing that doesn't need spin is how I think you're going to enjoy our next segment on Milan. Really enjoyed chatting with Steve. We talked about the transfer window, did some over-unders, talked about the team in general. I think you will really enjoy that. Okay, we've been wanting to talk about Milan, and I'm very excited to welcome a very good friend of the show, Steve, from the fantastic Milan Weekly Podcast, which is the English voice of our friends Radio Rossonera in Italy, a great radio station focused on Milan. Steve is a lot of fun. I think you guys who have heard him on before really enjoy him. Definitely check out his own podcast as well, Steve. So it's a real pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
David, again, thank you very, very much for having me on again. And to all the Calcioland listeners, this fantastic show. It's always a pleasure to represent Canada from Montreal, Milan Club Montreal, Milan Weekly Podcast. I love being on the show, Dave. You know, you send me the questions in advance, which I'm not used to, but every time I read your questions, I know that you're trying to get that reaction of me that you know I'm going to get.
Awesome. Well, you know, I know my guests and I love having you on and I love your energy. So, Steve, I know you guys did a show about this. The Mercato just ended. I would say Milan's Mercato started very strong, maybe not the ending some people wanted. So tell me, A, what grade do you give Milan overall? And how concerned are you that they didn't add a center back at the end of the window?
Yeah, so Dave, you know, I follow you and I follow everybody on the Mercato. I am a Mercato madness junkie. I love it. I don't take it seriously in terms of, like, I love the drama, the soap opera, the different storylines, the imagination also of certain deals that can and cannot be made. When it comes to Milan, look, I grade very difficult.
You're tough.
I'm tough because, and you know what? I respect everybody's opinion, and you know me on Twitter. I will take everybody's comment, but I will respond to you. And you might not like what I say, but that's the way I see it, and I've been like this forever, right? So for me, my grade to Milan's transfer window would be a C.
Okay.
And
how
I'm giving
that
them
have
a C.
Go ahead.
No, sorry about that. I'm giving them a C, not because we didn't get a center back, but that's part of it. But also, look, they started off the Mercato really, really well. And, you know, they made certain signings and re-signings, which I bundle up into the Mercato as well, right?
Yeah.
Like, Rebic becoming permanent, getting Zlatan to sign on again.
Yeah.
But there's certain things, you know, like the Tonali signing was something that was really, I was really proud of it because it stayed under the radar. It was a surprise. That's usually not like Milan of the past couple of years. It would always be some sort of drama and then we'd be disappointed. I was very happy with the Tonali signing. Did we pay too much? I think we paid fair market value for a young Italian with a huge ton of upside. And
yeah.
You know what? I know your question after is going to get me going. So this one here, I'll stay a little bit brief. But I was disappointed, and a lot of people wrote back to me when I said I was disappointed that we didn't get a center back. It's because I really believe that we're an injury away from a total disaster in the back end. We lose Kajar, you know, I love to mispronounce everybody's name, and we don't have Romagnoli back. We're starting two center backs that unfortunately either don't have the experience or are not da Milan to continue to get us to that fourth spot.
Yeah, I think that's very fair because, look, they haven't given up any goals so far in Serie A. And granted, it's been a soft schedule, but you are right. They've already been without Romagnoli. It's worked so far. But one more injury, or even when Romagnoli comes back, it's no guarantee against better opposition you can sustain
yeah.
it. So I think that's very fair.
Yeah. Just to add to that, there before people destroy me on Twitter, I appreciate the other signings. You know, like we needed a backup keeper. Does he has Serie A experience? Tiramisu, I like to call him. is he the one who's going to save us? If knock on wood, Gigio Donnarumma has an injury, I don't think that's going to happen. The other signings, you know. Dalot and Brahim Diaz, those are dry loans, right? So for me,
yeah.
They're exciting, but can Milan convince those players to stay? And will the teams that they loan them from, are they willing to dance with Milan and leave them at Milan so that they can purchase them at 100%? Mm-hmm. I don't know, right? And, you know, we have the Norwegian player that we took a risk on. And I love those types of deals because it's like an Atalanta type of move. You know,
yeah.
Which I love Atalanta, right, David? Got a
dance
yeah. like Gasperini. And and that's why I rounded up at a C, just because I think that, you know, that center back position and the right wing position were something that they needed to at least attend to. You want to bring in a dry loan, try someone in those two positions as well, and I think it would have been a better grade.
Okay, fair. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about Tonali. You mentioned the exciting signing, and I totally agree with you. I think value-wise, it's fine, and he's a young player. Worst-case scenario, his value will not drop, and you'll amortize it. But then, so I think the value's fine. But I want to ask you, how you see him fitting into the team? Because we know he's not in great shape. He didn't really have summer preparation. And with Brescia, the season ended on a low point. So that's fine. But he's shown flashes. He clearly has a big team talent. So how do you see him fitting in? And, you know, in a way, Milan improved the strength. Because we can say Bennacer and Kessie were really sensational at the end of last season. And they've continued it on now. So he fits into that. And in a way, it's a little similar to Juve with Chiesa, bringing a young Italian player at a position where they're already deep. So how do you see Tonali fitting in? And in general, how excited are you that he's on the team?
So I'll start with the first question. Very excited. And we talked about it before he came to, he was actually purchased from Milan. We had said on the podcast with Vinny talking about Tonali, and it's not selfishly because I'm a Milanista and I wanted him to see Tonali at Milan. But I thought for his career, that move to Inter would have been devastating because he would have struggled to find space at Inter. And at Milan, yes, we're trying to ease him in. And I tell everybody, manage your expectations with this young guy. Everybody fell in love with the story that he's a Milanista from a young age, and now he's playing with his dream team. He's living every Milanista's dream. But let him dream. Let him slowly fit into the team, like we did with Benassad. Came from Empoli, didn't start right away, and everybody was saying, we need to have him in. But maybe, you know, myself as well, right? You get super excited and you want to see the player. But the player needs to acclimate a bit to the team and to the different characters that are on there. And now he forms this fantastic partnership with Kessié. But let's face it, you know, if it's not for COVID, these two guys are burnt out at halfway point of the season. And I think that COVID played a big part in Benassad and Kessié doing so well at the end of the season, because they kind of got an all-star break in the middle of the season. I think that Tonali will fit in now, like Pioli is doing right now. It's one for one for Benassad. I would like to see that combo continue. Tonali and Kessié, Benassad and Kessié, or Benassad and Krunic. I think Krunic deserves a shot, and I think he would be able to give Kessié some rest, well-deserved rest. But the end goal, and I've said this, and people are like, oh, you're crazy, Steve. What do you guys do in Canada? What do you guys do in Montreal? There's too many dance clubs in Montreal. And I tell them,
other clubs too, not just dance clubs.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it. And the thing with that is, in the end, Pioli's going to have a tough job on his hands. He's going to need to find a way to make them all play at the same time. I don't know.
Well said. Go ahead. Very well said.
I don't know how, but there's going to be a certain time where Tonali is going to mature. Benassad and Kessié, the three, will need to play at the same time, especially in really tough games, because of the quality that they bring. And it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because we need to do a lot of work. As much as, Milan Twitter and Milanisti fans think we are guaranteed that fourth spot, I think that we have a lot of work to do, and it's going to be an interesting season.
Yeah. And we'll get to that about the Champions League spot, because that's a very interesting topic. So let's keep talking about the midfield. And, you know, it's really remarkable how things turned around. And I would say even before Tonali arrived, you could have made a case based on the way they played in the post, pandemic calcio. And you make a good point. They had a break in between, is how good Calhanoglu has been as well. And we are talking about Milan having one of the best midfields in Serie A, especially now with Tonali on board. And we've talked about Kessié's resurgence, but Calhanoglu, I would say, maybe even a little bit more. So what do you make of that? You know, obviously a talented player, but what do you think clicked for him that now all of a sudden he's become such a dominating player?
Yeah, so Hakan, it's a couple of seasons that we see the same thing, right, David? We have a slow start to the season, and then near the end where things maybe, again, it's just my opinion. I think things get a little bit less stressful because either Milan is not fighting for the Champions League spot or there's not a tough game coming up. And you saw that these past couple of seasons, near the end of the season, you would have a surge where he would have a couple of goals, a couple of more assists. He would play more consistently. And last year, with the break in COVID, you know, I think that Pioli really gave him that confidence, keeping him in when he wasn't really playing well. And then when he did start playing well, actually playing him in the right position where he could succeed and he was happy. And I'm not being a Monday morning quarterback here. I have been, since he started, probably one of the toughest persons on Hakan Çalhanoğlu. Like, he probably hates me if he knows I exist. If he knows I exist, he hates me. Because I found ways to dissect this game where, you know, unfortunately, I was just saying the truth, though, Dave. You know, like if you can't make a 4-foot pass, there's something wrong upstairs sometimes. And I understand that because the player is human. He's a young kid. We forget that they're kids. And, you know, he has his own problems, his own personal issues, and you forget that. But if you look at and you just look at what's happening on the field, that's when sometimes you say, you know what? Now something clicks, some serenity happened in maybe his personal life or outside the pitch where he doesn't have these distractions. He's playing where he feels comfortable. He's around people Kessie and Benacer, who do a lot of the ball winning for him, where, you know, in the past when we weren't playing that well, he was contributing defensively. So I think it's a mixture of everything. I can't put my finger on it. I'm very happy for him. And, you know, like, I'm tough on these players, but in the end, I love Milan and I want them to succeed. Now, is Hakan Çalhanoğlu a Milan number 10? Guys, let's get serious. Go down the list of people that have worn number 10. He's not a 10, but he's a serviceable player for Milan right now who, you know, the game against Spezia, coming in the second half and changing the game. That's something that, you know, I tip my hat to him and Pioli for making those changes. And, you know, that's great for his confidence. And I can only wish him that he continues like this forever. And then when we get to renegotiating the contract, then it's going to get complicated.
Okay, fair enough. And you are tough for someone, you know, we think Canadian people really nice. You're such a funny, humorous guy, but you are tough. And that's why it's great to have you on the show. So let's talk a little bit about the wing position, which I know you are concerned about, and for good reason. So let's see if, in your opinion, which of these players will have the better season between Castillejo, Sellemakers, who today was named MVP of a Belgians game, and the Norwegian new addition, Hodge. If you had to bet now, who do you think will have the better season?
Salchicha maker is going to have the salchicha maker, salad maker is going to have the best season of the three, because okay. I think Castillejo will struggle with injury and playing time, and Hodge will need to acclimate himself like salad maker had to do when he first started at Milan. He has to get his feet wet, and then maybe next season will be a good season for him. But you know what? This signing, again, was another one of those signings where I'm not going to pretend to know who he was before Milan signed him. And we signed him as a right back. And I think I maybe saw him play right back once. So he is that right wing. And you know what? He might not be the most talented, but he is going to give you at least 90 minutes of pure 100%. He's going to leave everything on the field, as Castillejo will. But Castillejo, unfortunately, in the final third, sometimes he looks like someone who's lost in a maze of mirrors. He's overthinking himself, not really confident with the ball, and it's frustrating the other people. And Castillejo, by history, has suffered with injury problems throughout the season. So if I have to pick one, it's Salsa Maker.
Okay, good one. So you mentioned the kind of break Milan, like every team in Serie A, got because of the pandemic, unfortunately, and how that contributed certainly to Benacer and Kessie ending the season so strong and being able to play so many games. But there's another concern that's been brought up more specific to Milan is, you know, the jitters of having to play in front of a big crowd at San Siro for a lot of these young players. And one of the reasons why Zlatan was brought in was to help with that, and he certainly did. So in your opinion, do you buy this argument that there's that some of these players will not do as well once there's a packed San Siro, hopefully as soon as possible?
I'm on the fence with this. I really want to see. I want to judge once there's actually people in the stands and how many can be in the stands, right? So difference with 1,000 people at the San Siro and 70,000 people at the San Siro, right? But these players and this argument here is something of a cop-out for me. They can't. These are professional players. As much as they're young, as much as they're kids, they've been playing at a top level for a long, long time. The San Siro is a heavy stadium to play. The Milan jersey is a heavy stadium. But we're starting to see that change in the mentality, the Zlatan, the way the actual organization is functioning now. Thinking a little bit outside the box, going to get these younger players, mixing them with a little bit more veteran players. I really don't want to say yes, I buy it, or no, I don't buy it, because I want to see them in the stadium for a hand or like a 10 game, and then from there make a decision on it. Is it really that? Because if it's that, you know what the Milan fans are going to do. They're going to abandon the stadium. They'd probably rather see Milan win than go watch them run. And it comes directly from Italy, that, right? I had the pleasure, you know, and becoming friends with Ale Jacopone from Milanista Roma Voluto. And he had me on, and he had me talking Italian or Calabrese, whatever dialect, and they were making fun of me. You know, the people in the north, they always make fun of the south.
Yeah.
And they were saying, they were talking about this topic too. And they all, like, just said it with a straight face. They said, if we go back to the stadium and they start losing, oh, we're going to do something, and that we're going to get kicked out of the stadium, and they're going to ban the stadium for 3-4 games, and we're going to win, and we're going to start all over again, right? So we'd rather see them win than sit in the stands and watch the game.
Awesome. Great anecdote. Okay, so now you mentioned it earlier, and, you know, this is something that I always think about when trying to think of rankings for teams, because I think it's hard to argue against the fact that Milan improved during this transfer window. There are more good players on the team than before, but Serie A has raised the bar in general. I think most of the top teams have improved as well. So where do you rank Milan currently compared to the rest of Serie A, and how confident are you that Milan can get back to the Champions League? Because I get the enthusiasm from the fans. There should be enthusiasm after this window, but there's also some good teams in Serie A. So how do you see this race shaking out?
Yeah, I see them, Dave, unfortunately, out of Champions League. And it hurts me to say it. And I know a lot of people these past couple of months have they've been hard, right? They're like, oh, Steve, you're so negative, and I can't believe this. So we're making great buys, and I get it. It's just I'm like this by nature. I like to manage my expectations of what team I'm following. And I see Milan, and I remember Milan from when I started watching them, and I understand that the game has changed, and I've accepted that. And the game has changed, and Milan has changed, right? We went from, you know, one of the most loved / hated owners in all of Italy to a fund that, you know, maybe didn't even know about soccer till someone convinced them to purchase this ridiculously stupid loan from Yong Hong Lee for a tenth of what the club is worth, right? And now, you know, it's a business, right? So I like what Milan's doing also with, you know, Rock Nation, and, you know, we have people in the NBA wearing Milan jerseys. And I think it has, like, potential to grow as a brand and as a club, like Serie A has the potential to grow as a league. But in terms of Champions League and what we're putting on, we've always had this trouble of debt, right? And now we're still playing three competitions, with Europa League included, where I don't know if we have enough depth to compete in all three competitions. And at a certain point, you're going to have to make a decision, right? And is it Europa League? Is it Coppa Italia? Is it, are you too far back from fourth place? So what I see, Milan, I see them around that fifth, you know, really pushing fourth, fifth, sixth, you know, because I have like, you know, Atalanta, Juve, Inter, and I'm adding Napoli there as well. I'm not 100% convinced with Napoli either, because I like their moves. I like what they did. I like that they didn't have to give up anybody. You know, they kept Koulibaly. They broke their transfer record on Osimhen, and not even in the Champions League. So, you know, you got to tip your hat to that that type
of
thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But, you know, I love Gattuso. I loved him at Milan. I loved him as a player, as a coach. Great man, motivator. But when his back is pushed up against the wall, will he have that plan B to get them out of trouble? I'm not 100% convinced that he has that plan B.
Yeah, I mean, those are the top four that I have as well. And I think it's very fair. I see Milan right, and I see them better than Roma, which is already saying a lot in previous years. I think they have a very good chance of finishing ahead of Lazio. It's going to be tough to break into the top four, but not out of the question. So I agree with your ranking. So now let's get to the fun part of the show. We're going to do some over-unders. We did them last year, so we're going to do them again this time. So we're going to do, these are just in Serie A. We're going to do some goals for some players and some clean sheets for Donnarumma. So let's start with Zlatan, who unfortunately still is tested positive for COVID. Let's wish him the best. Let's assume he can get healthy very soon. So I'm going to set an overrun because last season he was amazing in a half a season. He was on pace for 20 in a season. So I'm going to set an overrun there at 16 and a half because of his age, health concern, but he does have two already. So to go over, he would need 14 and a half. So he would need 15 essentially to go the over. So how do you feel about Zlatan this season? And for argument's sake, let's assume at least COVID is not a concern long term.
If he's healthy, over. And it's basically only about health with Zlatan. He does take the spot kicks as well. So that that plays into it a little bit, as you know, he's not always the one working for the goal, but he's going to end up with the goal. And, you know, will he score them all? No. But I think that him, just as a professional and the way he treats his body and the way he trains, I believe that he will be able to stay healthy even when he comes back from this COVID scare. And I think that, again, like I said, I remember the show last year that we did together, like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And all my answers were, if fourth place is the milestone for Milan, he better get more than 15 goals.
Okay. So now let's go to one of our favorites, just to say his name, Leao. So I'm going to set a good Leao. So last season he had six. So I'm going to raise the bar for him all the way to 9.5. But I think for good reason, because he has two already. Rabic is going to be out just for a little bit, and Zlatan doesn't look like he'll probably play immediately. So he has two. Last season he had six. I'm going to set it at 9.5. So he's going to need eight more to go over that. Do you think he can do it?
Under for Leao.
For
everybody who's listened to me on Milan Weekly Podcast or wherever else you catch me, I'm tough on Leao because, you know, the club invested quite a bit of money on Leao. I think the talent is there. And what just frustrates me is games like Crotone, where, you know, Rebic goes out with an injury. We bring in Leao. Zlatan's not there. And it looks like he's walking around the pitch for about 15, 20 minutes, right? So everybody's going to say, Steve, you're crazy. You went on David Amoyal's Calcio line and you said under to the superstar layout. Guys, you got two goals against Spezia after sleepwalking the first half and they were two tapping. There was, you know, everybody would say, look at this compilation and look at that compilation, where they show you just the fancy scissors around the ball, or the spinorama, or the fancy trick, but the 4 foot pass that he missed, you'll never see it in there. So for me, Leal, unless he puts his head on straight and gets a little bit more serious, is going to be under that 9.5.
Okay. Well, I'm going to still enjoy saying his name anyways. You can't stop me. Next up, Brahim Diaz had a good day today. He's off to a good start at Milan, showed some very good flashes. But I don't want to go crazy. I'm going to set the over-under at 6.5, knowing that he already has one. So he needs 6 goals to go over that. Do you think he will?
I don't see him as a scorer. That's why I see if this would have been assists, I would have probably said, yeah, you know what, David, I'll go over. But I don't see him as a scorer. I see him more as a playmaker, more of that fantasista type of player.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to, I think he would finish around 6 goals. And I would be really happy with 6 goals as well, especially someone who's never played in Serie A before. And, you know, has struggled at everywhere he's been to get some time for, I don't know why, Man City and Real Madrid. But I think he'd be on that 6 mark. And I'd have to say under, because I don't think he would crack that and get to 7 goals.
Okay. So now let's go to Rebic. Obviously had a fantastic season, played very well with Zlatan. He's hurt now, but luckily it doesn't seem too bad. He has yet to score. I'm going to set an over-under at 12.5. How do you feel about Rebic?
I like Rebic because I call him ice cold, right? He can score a goal and he has absolutely no emotion, which for me is really when you're watching on TV, it's like, did we score? Like, hey, Dave, did we score? I don't really know what's going on. Like, did we score? Are we going to VAR? I don't get it anymore. Like, and I like that ice cold from Rebic. So, and I like the way he plays. I think he has a little bit of nastiness to him and he links up well on the left-hand side with Theo Hernandez. And we saw that when we tried to put him up top in Zlatan's spot, he looked really uncomfortable. So if he can play on the left-hand side and work that magic with Zlatan and Theo and on that offer and creating stuff for Milan on that side, we need him at more than 12 goals. So I'm going to say over to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, we need someone to be over. Okay, so now let's talk about clean sheets and Donnarumma, and we're talking about Gigio, of course, here. So, Milan's off to a good start. They have 3 already. Granted, it's been a soft schedule, but this is without Romagnoli. So, last year they had 12, and because they have 3 already, I'm going to be pretty aggressive. Setting an over-under at 14.5. So to go over, they are going to have to match the 12 clean sheets from the rest from last season, minus the games they've played so far.
Again, I'm going to repeat myself, and I'm going to stick with my winning ways from last year when you had me on. And my message will remain the same. If we need to make Champions League and we want that 4th spot, we need him to keep some balls out of the net, especially in those tough games. And, you know, everybody, I'm going to take Milan's side on this part, on this point here. Everybody's going to say the soft schedule. Go look at last year against, the teams that were at the bottom of the table. We would let in that stupid goal and either go behind and have to come back or be winning 3-0 and destroy his clean sheet. So I think that keeping a clean sheet against these teams at the beginning of the season is going to give them confidence. Romagnoli coming back and Kajar staying healthy is going to be key to us making Champions League and keeping the ball out of the net. So for Donnarumma and his clean sheets, over the 14.5.
Love it. Okay. So, Steve, it's been absolutely awesome to have you on. I don't know how anyone who didn't hear this interview is not going to want to tune in to Milan Weekly Pod. So tell our listeners what they can hear on the podcast and also There's a fantastic Milan club in Montreal where you mentioned it. So tell us a little bit about what's going on with that as well.
Yeah, we'll start with Milan Club Montreal because that's what got Milan Weekly Podcast started again. Look, guys, in Montreal, if we can ever travel again, and you guys make yourself, if you guys take a trip to La Belle Province, Quebec is the province, Montreal is the city, and the country is Canada. So please look up Milan Club Montreal and come and watch a game with us on Sundays. We usually go to a fantastic bar Chacharo, who treats us very, very well. All the members get together. We watch with different clubs sometimes, the Juve club, the Inter club. And you know what? We try to do some good stuff around the community with Milan Club Montreal. Donating to the Southside Toy and Food Drive where, they collect the unperishable goods around the holidays.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to happen this year, but we'll try to do that again. We're going to try to do something with Fondazione Milan, which will be very interesting. Again, unfortunately, I can't tell you more details than that because I don't have the details. With COVID, we don't know what's going to happen, but right now, Milan Club Montreal is doing the membership drive. It's $20 just to join this year. You have access to some of the discounts that we have across the city with different businesses like Evangelista Sport, where you can buy gear for your favorite calcio team, and so much more, right? Dairy Queen is even a sponsor. Imagine that.
We'll get that's even awesome.
Ice cream if you join the club. Once you buy an ice cream and you buy a jersey at Evangelista, you've already paid your membership 2 times, right? So it's a small fee just to keep the club running. Usually some years we come out with a nice scarf, a nice hat, the membership's a bit more. So that's Milan Club Montreal. If you want info at Milan Club Montreal, for any information on that, and we have our own Twitter account and Facebook page, so you can look us up. For Milan Weekly Podcast, Dave, I never like to tweet my own horn, but we have a lot of fun. We've had you on multiple times. Oh, yeah. And we want to have you on again. We started this video, we went back to the video, Dave, so everybody gets to see my sexy body on YouTube, and we go at it, So me and Vinny have been doing this for a long time. We started with Red Card Weekly, and now we're at almost 200 episodes of Milan Weekly Podcast.
That's awesome.
And interviews, and we swear, and we yell, and we yell at each other, we yell at the fans, we yell at the people sending us comments. We're continuously yelling at people, and it started now. I think Dave, you probably go through it. You went through it before. I've got some trolls. Some people who are trying to steer my emotions sometimes. And I keep on telling people on the show. I say, guys, I don't even know what a troll is. I don't care what you write to me. You can write it. I'll reply back and I'll respect your opinion. It's like I think they're even mad at me. Milan Weekly Podcast, Dave, is something really special because we don't even know what you're going to get from show in and show out. We don't have a script. We don't prepare anything. We're just two guys talking. And because we love Milan, it's just organically comes out as we don't know what you're going to get, right? So I would love to tell people exactly what you're going to get when you watch Milan Weekly Podcast, but from week to week, I don't even know what I'm going to get from Milan Weekly Podcast.
Great stuff. Well, Steve, I had a lot of laughs. I'm sure most of our listeners did as well. I can't thank you enough. I look forward to chatting with you again. And everyone, definitely check out Milan Weekly Pod.
David, thank you very much. And all the cultural and listeners, support David and everybody on the show. It's a fantastic show. His Mercato updates and madness that he does throughout all this time is all worth it. He's a gentleman. And please, guys, stay strong, stay positive, and we're going to get through all this shit, and we're going to love culture once again. Let's go.
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to that segment with Steve as much as I enjoyed recording it. So next segment available to all, we're going to close with my dear friend Andrew Barker. I figured this was a good interview for the weekend. Longtime listeners of Calcio Land know that we love talking pop culture. Haven't done it much with the transfer window, but we're going to pay tribute to Eddie Van Halen. We will incorporate more pop culture during the season. I have to say, you know, to pay tribute to one of my favorite musicians ever with someone of Andrew's caliber was really awesome for me. So if even if you're not really into music or whatnot, I think you will enjoy this segment. We did talk a little bit about Inter at the top, but I definitely encourage you to check out the rest. Even if you're not that familiar with Eddie Van Halen, I think you'll enjoy this discussion. I'm thrilled to welcome our next guest, the one of my absolute favorites, Andrew Barker, senior writer at Variety, the pop culture guru of Calcioland and of Twitter, in my opinion. Big Inter fan, but today he's here to talk a little bit about Eddie Van Halen. You guys know I love Andrew's writing. I love chatting with him. The last time he was on was way too long. We had chatted about a lot of different topics, but today we are going to talk a little bit about Inter at the top and then talk about the life and legacy of Edward Van Halen. So, Andrew, I really, really appreciate you doing this. I love doing these segments with you. So, welcome back to Calcioland.
Thanks for having me as always. It's always fun.
Okay, so let's start with Inter, Andrew. I loved your tweet in the first game of the season. You mentioned that Inter had improved in every area on the pitch, but they decided they had the best defense and to start with two fullbacks on defense in pure Pazza Inter fashion. But they ended up winning their game, and a lot of people, including me and others, have picked Inter to win the Scudetto. So how do you feel about Inter being seen as a favorite? It's been a while since that's been the case.
It's been forever. Yeah, it's weird. I'm not used to it. I just hope we finish the season. You know, I feel like all the usual variables that would go into who wins the Scudetto are like, there's that extra X factor now too of like, well, who's going to be available to play in any given week. So that's very weird. But I mean, even without that, I still wouldn't want to say that I think Inter are favorites or anything. But I think the fact that Inter has, for the first time in a long time, put themselves in a position where it would be a failure if they didn't win the Scudetto. You know what I mean? It's unusual because, I mean, this team basically had like seven consecutive rebuilding seasons, you know, in a row, and like 4 year zeros in a row where the objective every year was just improvement. You know, it was getting back into Europe or getting out of FFP restrictions or just sort of like improving in some general way. But, you know, there's always like an excuse or reason to keep things reasonable. And so I feel like this is the first season where, yeah, it would be a failure if they didn't win the Scudetto, which is an unusual feeling for Inter. But I think they definitely have a great chance if things go normally. And yeah, it's good to have things expected of the team you watch as opposed to just, you know,
absolutely
do the best you can do, guys. You know, kind of, yeah. So that's refreshing for sure.
Yeah. So now let's talk about this next thing because, you know, in my opinion, Inter's really in a lot of ways mortgage kind of the future to go all in here. And before we get to the players they passed on, they were seriously flirting with the idea of selling Milan Skriniar, who I know is a player like you, like many Inter fans, have a lot of affection with. So what did you make of him being on the block? How nervous were you that he might actually leave? And I'm assuming you're happy that he ultimately stayed.
I am. I'm ecstatic that he stayed. And I was just baffled, honestly. I mean, I would have been livid if Skriniar had been sold this summer, especially considering, like, I mean, I always kind of expected him to be at the club a lot longer than Antonio Conte, frankly, you know.
Yeah.
So it blows my mind a little, you know, because, you know, like you were saying, like, I feel like if you look at this squad from last season to this one, in every other single position, you know, be it forwards, midfielders, wingers, even goalkeeper, like, the team has improved without messing too much with the core formula. Like, every position is mostly the same but better, except for the defense. And that just, it baffles me because, I mean, I feel like Conte must be chasing some very specific vision here, you know, where he has this idea that he can have, like one real central defender, and then basically left and right center backs were basically fullbacks, you know, which you see him doing with, you know, putting Kolarov or D'Ambrosio or whomever. I mean, I feel like he would play Nagatomo at center back if he could, you know. And maybe that could work, you know, like maybe there are advantages to that, and that's kind of like his, you know, new sort of vision for how to change the way football is played. But, you know, and I think like Bastoni is probably a clue to what Conte really wants to see in that position, because he plays like a fullback sometimes, even though he's a center back. But it feels needlessly risky, you know, because you look at, I mean, you know, Inter's 1-2, drawn 1, but you look at the amount of goals they conceded thus far. And you just, I mean, to teams who, you know, no offense to Fiorentina, aren't really top tier teams, you know, who put, you know, 3 goals and 2 goals against them. And like I said, you know, they had the best defense in the league last year. And, you know, the old cliche, defenses win titles. So why would you want to dramatically rethink your whole defensive structure and philosophy over an unusually short summer window when what you should be doing is just trying to close that tiny little gap between you and the title, you know? That seems pointlessly risky to me. And so selling Skriniar, especially after they lost Godin, would have just been the most dramatic way possible for Conte to have just committed, you know, to this not entirely fully baked strategy. And like, I get it that Skriniar is not the most natural fit for a 3-man defense. You know, he's best in a traditional 4-man line, at least at this point. But he's still like an elite level center back. I mean, one of the best in the league.
Yeah.
And so the idea of just getting rid of him, like at the end of the transfer window, when the season's already ongoing, when you could just rely on a reliable, you know, like defensive setup that you had from last season. I'm not quite sure what he was thinking there, and I'm glad he was unsuccessful at it.
yeah, for sure. So let me just ask you real fast before we get to Van Halen. So, you know, in this year alone, Inter pretty much had in their hands Kulusevski, Tonali, Kumbula. They've all seen them go to other teams. You know, Conte wanted more veterans, I guess. Does that give you even more urgency to win the title this year, kind of going more for short term? Is it possible that if Inter doesn't win, you're going to look back and be like, oh my God, we passed up on all these guys too?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. I mean, yeah, anytime you opt for, you know, 87-year-old Arturo Vidal over Sandro Tonali, you know, the next Pirlo, allegedly, I mean, you're setting yourself up to look really stupid if it doesn't pay off. And I mean, I guarantee that I'll look back 4 years from now and just be incredulous over at least one of those three players you mentioned,
yeah,
you know, that, you know, he could have been there and they let him go. And so, yeah, so it is committing to a short-term strategy for sure, because a lot of these players Conte brought in aren't going to be here, aren't going to be playing professional football probably in, you know, 3 years or so. But I mean, on the other hand, you know, it's not like Inter is just like all, you know, Bengay and denture cream these days, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
they got, for sure,
you know, Hakimi and Barella and Lautaro and Bastoni even. I mean, I think those are as, you know, as enviable a core of young players as I think almost any club in Italy has right now. And it could be a better core of young players, but, you know, I think the only way to judge this is if he wins the Scudetto with, you know, Vidal and, you know, Kolarov and all those guys, then it'll be worth it. And if he doesn't, then we get to make fun of him. So
absolutely,
you know, he put his chips there. Yeah, so
for sure. And you're absolutely right. They do have a core of young players that really the envy of any team in Italy. So well said there. So now let's talk about one of my favorite musicians ever. Passed away this week. I have to say, I wasn't really surprised. I know Eddie Van Halen was sick for a while, hadn't toured in ages. I tweeted that he taught the masses what the word virtuoso meant, but you, of course, had a much better explanation of his legacy that I think in a way is a little bit similar. And I loved your tweet, which was one of the most technically skilled guitar players who ever lived, and a person who decided to use those remarkable gifts, making songs you could dance and drink beer to, which was the correct decision. So, A, if you want to expand a little bit on that and tell me, how common is it in the world of music or in entertainment in general where you have a performer who's just so technically skilled but is really commercial in a lot of ways? And do you think the vast majority of the people that consumed Van Halen's music were aware of what a great musician he and the other guys in the band were too?
That's a good question. I mean, I think certainly with vocalists, you see that a lot. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, Sinatra or Aretha Franklin or Marvin Gaye or whomever. I mean, I think everyone was aware that these were, you know, elite level craftsmen and craftswomen of their particular, you know, instrument. Probably less likely with an instrument or like with a guitar, but, you know, I think, and, you know, just, you know, to expand, you know, you asked me kind of what I meant by that. I mean, I think what's fascinating about Eddie is that, you know, you think about like the all time rock guitar Mount Rushmore, you know, like the most obvious first ballot Hall of Famers for rock and roll guitar players. And Eddie Van Halen is obviously there, and Hendrix is obviously there. And then, you know, you probably think Clapton, Page and Beck, and, you know, depending on your personal tastes, you know, you could say Eddie Hazel or Tom Verlaine or David Gilmour, Joe Satriani, Randy Rhoads, like whoever you kind of choose. But when you look at like all those players, like anyone you're going to pick, Eddie Van Halen is probably better than all of them except for Hendrix. And if you look at all those guitar players, pretty much all of them, or none of them really, made music that was as populist or just kind of as dumb as Van Halen did.
Yeah.
Know? And I mean dumb in the most complimentary possible way, you know, like dumb in a great way, like because you didn't need to know anything about music at all to appreciate Van Halen. You know, you didn't even have to have any interest in guitar virtuosity to appreciate Van Halen. You didn't need to pay attention to it to appreciate Van Halen. You know, it was music that sounded best while you're drinking beer on the hood of a Camaro in the parking lot, or if you're on spring break in Cancun, or if you're, you know, washing your car in the driveway in Jersey in the summer, you know, like, I mean, at least with the David Lee Roth albums, it was just the most utterly unpretentious music. And it was all about chicks and partying and rocking out. And that was basically it. Except if you bothered to really pay attention, you might notice it was this extremely melodically precise, just ruthlessly technically demanding music that only the top, you know, tiny portion of a percent of guitar players in the world could actually pull off. But you didn't need to know that. You know, you didn't have to know that. Like, you know, for being one of the greatest guitar players who ever lived, like, Van Halen seemed just as concerned with making great pop music as with playing a great solo. And I think that's extremely rare. So I just like that that's what he chose to do with his talent. He could have gone to the conservatory, you know, and then played classical guitar, and he would have been one of the best classical guitar players alive. Or he could have, you know, done like these prog rock epics, you know, and rock operas and stuff. But he just, you know, he wanted to make Panama, you know. So I think that was an excellent use of his gift. Is I think what
very
I
mean. Absolutely great stuff. So on him specifically, his playing, and I agree. I think at the end of the day, his biggest legacy is that if you ask, you know, people who are the greatest guitar players ever, he's absolutely one of the first names there. But what is it about him that you think caught him there? You know, as last time, a while ago, when we were talking about Tom Petty's guitar player, you mentioned how guitar tone is so important to musicians almost as much as their technique. Is it that? Is it his famous tapping ability, his riffs, anything per se, a combination of these things? When you think of Eddie Van Halen as a guitarist, what stands out to you the most?
I mean, I think for the average person, like, you can't talk about Eddie without talking about the fret tapping. And you know, I think what's really remarkable about that is, you know, the way he did what he did in Eruption went from, like, just making everyone lose their minds and going, like, how the hell did he do that, to almost being, like, a cliche of rock and roll in, like, 5 years or so. Which isn't a criticism at all, because, like, I mean, the fret tapping, what he's doing, like, I mean, if one plays guitar, it's a difficult technique to master. But it's something you can learn if you put the practice in. You know what I mean? It's not impossible. I mean, thousands of people learned how to do that. You just have to put the work in. So what was special about it, though, was the way he developed it and used it, right? You know, it wasn't the technique itself and the level of difficulty, but it was just sort of the vision and creativity he had on how to develop that technique in such a interesting way that you know, made such an impact. But I think, you know, I think his guitar tone is a much, much harder thing to master than, like, even his craziest techniques were, you know, like, you know, if you know any lead guitar players, I mean, they spend probably as much time fussing with their tone and trying a billion different amps and speakers and pickups and effects pedals as they do, like, practicing scales, you know? I mean, I remember when I was in a band, our lead guitar player, I mean, he drove me insane. Just, you know, he'd play an E chord, then he'd move a knob a millimeter, then he'd play an E chord again, then he'd adjust the gain, then he'd play an E chord again. And then, like, I was a bass player, so, like, I just would plug into an amp and turn the volume up, and I was ready. Like, it drove me nuts. but, like, I mean, so lead guitar players are just almost psychotic in their pursuit of, like, a perfect tone. And Eddie's tone was probably the gold standard for how you wanted an electric guitar to sound for years. And, you know, it's like so much else about him where it's everything you like about the sound of a distorted electric guitar turned up to 11. You know, it's just, it's, I mean, like figuratively and literally. I love that he called it a brown sound, which is fascinating. Yeah. Like, you know, there's that a lot of musical geniuses have like a form of synesthesia where they see sounds as colors. And I would always try to listen to it. And I have no idea why you would describe it as brown. You know, that wouldn't have occurred to me. Like, to me, it sounds like if Hendrix's guitar tone was like a fine scotch, then Eddie's guitar tone was like a frozen margarita or something. You know, it was just like this sweet head rush just hits you in the head in a really pleasurable way. But
yeah.
But I mean, who else could find that? I mean, you know, people spend thousands of dollars trying to match that tone probably, and he came up with it. So I think that's equally as important. Yeah.
Yeah. And he literally built his guitars. I mean, that Frankenstein guitar, I mean, he literally got his hands on it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think he's one of those guys, you can just, even a few notes, you recognize him right away, and there's really not that many. So I've been listening, and I've been a big fan. I've been listening to them for a very long time, but you know, this week with the news, I've been listening nonstop. And you know, what really stands out to me is really the pure joy that stems from these songs. I think it's mainly the backing vocals, but in general, just the pure joy. And even Eddie, even I saw him live towards the end of his career, and he wasn't in great shape, but just the pure joy of playing. And I always think, I've always associated him and David Lee Roth as the ultimate California boys. And what I mean by that isn't so much, you know, the Sunset Strip or Beverly Hills or that, but more the state in general. I know you don't like talking about which are the best LA bands because it's a tough debate, but can you see why some people would associate Van Halen with California so much? Or is this just something unique to me?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I remember, I think he probably tweeted something like that like years ago, and it made me realize I'd never thought of Van Halen like that, but it fits 100%. I mean, you know, talking about his guitar tone, like, I mean, I remember reading that he, you know, when he was like a teenager messing with it, he actually took his pickups off and soaked them in surfboard wax to like reduce the hum of the coils in the pickup, which is like, I mean, that's as Californian as it gets right there. You know, Eddie Van Halen with his guitar pickups and surfboard wax. I think you're 100% right. It wouldn't have occurred to me, but it's a totally valid pitch. And I mean, to me, it always blew my mind that they were from Pasadena specifically.
Yeah.
Because just me personally, that's just a few minutes down the 210 freeway from where I grew up. And Pasadena is interesting because it's very much like a nice mid-sized Midwestern college town, except it happens to share a border with LA. So it's kind of an odd place, but it's not the kind of place you imagine the greatest guitar hero of all time coming from. And yet it's close enough to LA that you can make that trip pretty quick, you know? So, but that to me made Eddie Van Halen particularly relatable to me, you know, because it's like Jimi Hendrix was an alien and Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil and Jimmy Page was some kind of like dark mage wizard in a castle reading Aleister Crowley or whatever. Like those are their images. Whereas Eddie Van Halen could have been any of my friends growing up. You know what I mean? He was totally normal. You know, he was this middle class, biracial immigrant kid in a nice little suburban town who could have worked at a grocery store or been an accountant or something. But instead, he just decided to lock himself in his bedroom and practice until he became the greatest guitarist of all time. Like, I was never going to do that. I mean, that was an impossible aspiration for someone like me, but it was tangible, you know? There was nothing magic about him because, I mean, he was from Pasadena, you know,
You
know, if someone from Pasadena can do that, it's, but that's just more me, but I think them as the ultimate California boys makes 100% sense.
Absolutely. So I think most people, especially this week when talking about Van Halen, think more the first part of the career with David Lee Roth. I definitely think the first two albums really changed everything, created, in my opinion, the profile of the modern guitar hero. But you know, there's also a lot of their career was with Sammy Hagar. It was a very different band. If David Lee Roth bragged that he wasn't talking about love. He was talking about something else. Sammy Hagar, he was talking about love about every other song. They, of course, had more keyboards. It was a different band. But what do you make of that? Do you feel it might hurt his legacy that they were maybe a little bit less of a guitar band? Or do you think it's kind of a nice compliment and it makes him more of a more well-rounded musician?
I think it's definitely the latter. I know there were, I mean, even like back in the 80s, you know, Eddie would say in interviews that, you know, he actually didn't like the idea of Guitar Hero because to him, he was a musician, you know? I just never liked Sammy Hagar, you know, whether he was solo or with Montrose or with Van Halen. Like, I just didn't dig his vocal style or his vibe. He's not my thing. But I think the Van Hagar era, like, had plenty of great songs. And I actually find it interesting the way, you know, having someone less ridiculous than David Lee Roth in the band, it did kind of ruin that kind of like the dumbness of Van Halen that I said I liked.
Yeah.
But it also did free him up to be a little more serious, even like almost borderline pretentious, you know, Eddie. It's crazy when you think that in addition to being a guitar hero, he's also like a great composer of synth pop songs.
Yeah.
You know, like, if he never played guitar, I'm sure he would have been some kind of like cult hero, new wave synth guy, you know? So that part of the Van Hagar era is really interesting to me, even if Sammy himself sometimes kind of ruins it. But 5150 has some great stuff. I don't hate it.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I like it. It's just a different band. And I think it kind of makes him more of a well-rounded musician. So speaking of that, you know, I've always found very interesting in a way that very contradictory guy. So obviously he's a musical genius. His dad was a musician, classically trained from a young age, became a virtuoso at a young age. But, you know, he almost bragged about the fact that he really stopped listening to music. And he famously said the last record he ever bought or listened to was Peter Gabriel's Show, which for our listeners, that came out in 1986. And that he'd rather listen to the noise of his car than new music. So what do you make about that? Does that change how does that make you think about him as a musician? You know, he also said he could famously hear any song twice and be able just to play it. But the fact that then he just kind of lost interest, how do you feel about that? Does that change your opinion of him as a musician?
I don't know if it changes my opinion. I mean, it not as a musician. I find it interesting from a personality standpoint. I mean, I wish I could ask him follow-up questions about that, honestly, you know, just like, I don't know. I feel like everyone is, you know, I think of like, I mean, didn't like Gabriel Batistuta want to have his legs amputated when he was like at the end of his playing career? Like, I mean, I could see just, you know, being just the greatest in a certain field for a while would jade you. I don't know. I'm curious. It doesn't do anything to me in how I think of him as a musician, because that guy absorbed more musical ideas and forgot them than I've ever encountered. But I psychologically, I think that's fascinating. Especially because, I mean, he was still, you know, he seemed to be fine being sort of like a mentor figure, you know, to people like Dimebag and people like that. So just, the idea that he just didn't care what music they were making. I don't know. Like I said, that's to me, that's more psychologically interesting about him than reflective of anything he's done musically.
I don't know. It's fascinating to me because, you know, both my parents are classical musicians and they're really into it. And, you know, my dad's a pretty prominent violinist. And, you know, I played Van Halen for him. He's like, yeah, this guy's pretty amazing. So I just find it interesting. You know, he was really into classical music and all. But, you know, I know a lot was made of Billie Eilish saying she had never heard of Van Halen. So he didn't buy any records since 86. So neither did he with her. So I guess they're even there. Let me ask you, you know, when you think of the great American rock bands, you know, obviously most of the best ones I would say are from England, but there's a great tradition here in the U.S. of rock bands. Where do you kind of see Van Halen in the pantheon, you know, with the Aerosmiths, bands like that? Do you think Van Halen can make a claim to be in the Mount Rushmore of the greatest American rock bands?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I think they had such a... I don't want to say it's... I think they were massively influential in a way that you know, a lot of rock critics didn't particularly appreciate it at the time and maybe still don't now. But I think they represented a hugely just pivotal moment for the genre, in the sense that, I mean, their style would become so commonplace over the next several decades that it's weird to think about just how little they fit in like the late 70s rock scene, you know? I mean, there were people at the beginning, like label people who like wanted to market Van Halen as a punk band, which is obviously insane because they weren't even remotely a punk band. And in fact, they specifically hated punk. Like Eddie Van Halen hated it. But you just try to think of what the mindset would have been that you would say that. And it's like, well, they're not like a dark Sabbath style or Judas Priest style metal band. And they're not like a nerdy proggy band, you know, like Yes or Pink Floyd or Boston, more like Boston than any of those. But, and they're not like a rootsy country band like the Eagles. And they're clearly not a punk band. So like, what are they? And of course, like by the time they had broken big and you started seeing bands like Def Leppard and Motley and even something like the new wave bands like Duran Duran, it's like, okay, I see where they fit in now. Like they were an 80s band a couple years too early. But that lane wasn't really there when they started. I mean, Kiss was probably the closest thing, but even then, you compare the two and they, you know, there's really not that much comparison the more you drill down to it. So yeah, I think they were the defining 80s band, even if their best album came out in the 70s. One of the last really great, you know, whether you like the music or not, eras of just wildly over the top stadium rock. I mean, they were the prototype, you know, so. It's hard to, you know, take into account all the bands that came after them who drove in that lane, kind of, you know, who wouldn't have been there and not give them their due. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, what's amazing to me is, you know, a lot of the hair metal band definitely influenced by them. And I feel like, you know, if you want to look at them from a rock critic musicianship appreciation of that, you can do it. If you just want to enjoy it for the great riffs and the fun, I think you can do that too. And I just don't think there's that many bands that have that. So let's close on this, Andrew. And as always, it was fantastic to have you on. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this segment. Look, I'm assuming people that listen so far are fans of Van Halen, but maybe not that big of fans. If you had to pick three songs from their catalog that kind of showcase Eddie's brilliance, which ones would you pick?
It's a very interesting question. And I think it's sort of like, you almost have to put like an asterisk in the sense that, you know, I think you always mention this about bands whose first albums sound like greatest hits records. And Van Halen's definitely one of those bands. I mean, you listen to Van Halen 1 and most bands that would be their best of, you know. But looking beyond that, I mean, I would go with Dance the Night Away for sure, which I'm sure everyone's heard, because it's just a perfect little pop song with a perfect little riff. And I think it kind of shows off that underrated part of Van Halen's influence, you know, like if you listen to that song and really try to like just hone in on what it's doing and the dynamic shifts and which parts come in where, and then listen to something like Teenage Dream by Katy Perry, like those two songs are way more alike than they are different, you know? And you think about the fact that the guy who wrote Teenage Dream, Max Martin, you know, who wrote like a zillion other giant pop songs for Britney Spears and Taylor Swift and everybody, he was originally a failed 1980s glam metal guy who worshiped Van Halen, you know? So he's here in his second act of his career. Like he's applying the same sort of pop songcraft to Britney Spears that he learned from Van Halen. And really the only things that have changed are like some of the instruments and the imagery around it, like the aesthetics, you know, but like the structure and the theory of the music is the same. And I mean, you can really draw a pretty direct line, which I don't know. I find stuff like that fascinating.
It's a great pick. Fantastic tone. Got a very he's so good on that song, and it feels like a really straightforward song, but if you pay close attention, he's doing some pretty awesome things. So great pick. That was on my short list. You would pick almost anyone from the first album, right? I mean, do you have a favorite one if you have to pick one from that one?
Well, I have to pick one from the first album. Good question. I mean, like Eruption is obviously the, you know, sun bursting through the clouds, you know, that's the monkey touching the monolith in 2001, you know, kind of moment. I think Ain't Talking About Love is just the best song on that record. I just love that song. And it's also, it's a song you can play as a crappy guitar player like I am, you know, so like,
yeah,
which I always appreciate. You know, one of the ones I really like, is, that's not on that record is Mean Street,
great
which
choice.
I like mostly for the intro. Like I think that intro, like I like almost as much as Eruption as far as like the tapping technique goes. Because the way he's using that there, it's less about like impressing you with like this crazy flurry of notes than it is just like making a sound you couldn't possibly make with any other technique. You know, it's like, I mean, like, I think like Hendrix, he was just as stoked about making his guitarist just sound really weird as he was about winning some like Guitar World Reader's poll, you know? Which in a weird way kind of puts him not that far away from guys like Sonic Youth or like My Bloody Valentine, who I'm sure hated Van Halen, but like we're kind of the same in terms of like exploring just the sonic possibilities of the electric guitar and not just like how difficult can I make this run. So I like that one, and I mean, but I think like I think the number one, you know, testament to that band's brilliance and his, I mean, it's just Hot for Teacher, right? You know, I mean, it's just, I mean, for, it's one of the most fun songs ever recorded. Like,
really,
like I don't like
is.
To judge people. Like, you don't want to judge people based on their taste. You know, that's like a silly, immature thing to do. But if you met someone who didn't like Hot for Teacher, you'd assume they're like a miserable piece of garbage, right? I mean, you wouldn't want to hang out with them. You know, like that doesn't speak well to their character. And just as fun as it is, like, I love how weird that song is, which you only really notice like the 100th time you listen to it. You know, like. I mean, the song starts, it's a single, right?
It starts
off
it is.
With a 30, like a 30-second drum solo. You're like, okay, drum, like that's not the way to start a pop single. And then after that, you have Eddie doing this like very neoclassical, like Brahms-style guitar run. And then all of a sudden, it turns into a blues song with this riff that they ripped off of John Lee Hooker. And then it turns into like a T-Rex song on speed. And then it keeps pausing for like David Lee Roth to do this like drunken stand-up comedy routine. Like it's a really bizarre song, and it shouldn't work at all. And yet you listen to it and it's just like, oh, okay, I gotta speed down the highway now. That's your only response to it. You don't notice how strange it is, you know?
What a great pick. I love it. I feel my top pick is I'm the One from their first album, which to me in a lot of ways is the grandfather to Hot for Teacher. I feel it does have that stand-up comedy thing and the beginning. So great stuff, Andrew. I can't thank you enough. I really enjoyed this chat. Great stuff. I always tell anyone who tells me, oh, I need to improve my writing, what should I do, read Andrew's work on Variety. It's really fantastic. And let's not make it this long of a break between our podcast, Andrew. I can't thank you enough. This was awesome. Keep up the great work.
Absolutely. Thanks, David.